morning, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and I'm so happy to be back with all of you. I've missed you so much while I've been recuperating. Thank you for all your notes and your kind posts and everything else. My first show back is with the dynamic writing team of Preston and Child, international bestsellers. I cannot wait for you to hear what they have to say. So hang in there. We'll be right back with these gentlemen. Much for being with me tonight. I'm thrilled that you're here, and I'm even more thrilled that I have probably the most well-known and the best writing team in the business here with me tonight, Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. It is my honor to welcome both of them to Authors on the Air. Doug Preston, Lincoln Child, welcome. I'm so glad you're with me tonight. Thank you.
Well, it's good to be here.
Hello?
Yes, I'm
there. You go. So we were having a little conversation before the show started about temperatures and all. So it seems Doug is kind of freezing out in the southwest, and Lincoln and I are in Florida enjoying unseasonably hot weather. It's very humid at 80 to 85 degrees during the day. I've not had my air conditioner off at all. But you, Doug, are kind of out in the middle of the desert freezing your butt off. How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel fine now, and I'm going to feel even better when the hurricane wipes you two out.
I'm telling you, you don't understand that sucker's – they go up north now to the northeast. They don't even like Florida anymore. They don't come
well,
here.
Well, that may be true, but we haven't had a hurricane in Santa Fe in a couple of thousand years. So, you know, I think I'm safe here, even if we – yeah. It's cold,
yep,
but
don't
you get
snow on cacti, though? You get snow on cacti out there, though.
It's beautiful when it snows on the cactus. It's lovely. It's almost as nice as snow on the Christmas trees.
Doug's other house is in Maine, and you know, E.B. White wrote a great essay called "The Eye of Edna" about this hurricane that went up the coast and crashed Maine completely. So don't laugh, you know, at us, boy.
Yeah, be careful how you treat
well,
us over here.
I hope I haven't lost
don't
all
jinx
our,
us.
I'm just going to say, I think with my nasty comment, I probably lost all our Florida readers. But, you know, Link is a Florida resident. So. I hope not.
We're thrilled that you're in Florida, Lincoln. We really are. We're thrilled. You know, I was reading your bios on your website. I have to tell you, you two sound like an old married couple. I don't know if anybody's ever pointed that out to you before, but you're both really very funny, and you don't write funny books. You write thrillers that are very otherworldly and very horrifying. How did that happen?
Well, you know what? Before we answer that, I'd like to say that even though they're horrifying and terrifying, we have a lot of fun writing them. You know, we have fun with each other. And also, you know, if you look closely enough, you'll see we inject a bit of humor in between the mayhem and the bloodshed. And you know,
yes,
not all thriller writers do that. A lot take themselves and their books very seriously.
So,
yes, and,
so is
and
that
the,
kind
and
of
the,
a wink and a nod?
I'm
sorry,
Rob,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the writing process is, you know, very much a process like an old married couple bickering over what's going to be, what they're going to cook for dinner, you know? Well, we spend
and
a lot of time.
And the sex is terrible.
I know. Speak for yourself, Link. I mean, I thought last night was pretty good. No, no, that's why he's in Florida and I'm in Maine. You know, we are both happily married gentlemen. No, that's all joking around, right?
Yes.
I believe you. I believe you, but that doesn't preclude the fact that you are pretty funny when you're telling stories about each other. I want to ask you, though, have you ever been in the same space while you're creating a book together?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I don't know if you can call it creating, but we were in the same space when we were figuring out our very first book. I was living in Mayapack, New York at the time, just north of Westchester County, and Doug was in the city still. Mm-hmm. And he came up for a weekend, and we sat out in the Adirondack chairs on my front porch, and we drove around the Hudson Valley talking about Relic and in between shots of Jack Daniels. And that may be the only time that we spent an extended, protracted period of time together figuring a book out.
How fascinating.
Unless Doug can figure any other time.
Can you remember any other time, Doug?
Well, no, actually, you know, whenever Lincoln and I get together, we sit, we start talking about our agent and our editor, and we start talk bad-mouthing everyone, and we sit down
there
and we
go.
Have a little dram of single malt whiskey, and no work gets done, none. And we talk about what fine fellows we are, and so we have to work apart. If we're together, things go to hell.
So what I want to know is, someone made mention of De Quincey, the opium eater, in their bio, and so who was that pertaining to?
Well, that must be Lincoln. I never mentioned that.
No.
Lincoln's the opium eater, not me.
I take the fifth on that.
Okay.
I know Doug has a lot of weird relatives. You know, he's a senator for an axe murderer or something. Doug, who was that person?
Well,
you always bring up?
I do have an axe murderer and opium addict in my distant past. My dear aunt decided to do some research on our genealogy to uncover what kings and queens we were related to, and instead she found this axe murderer and also a really strange sexologist, and I think that was when she stopped.
Oh my gosh. You know, I want to ask you a few questions because your path to writing stardom was kind of a little bit different than most people. You were writing and then you were an editor first with St. Martin's Press, correct?
Yeah.
And then you left to go because you're kind of a geek. I say that with all love and caring and nurturing, that you are a computer geek. You like gadgets and stuff, correct? So you went to work at MetLife. Is that true?
Yes, it's true. I'll very briefly chart the course of my career. As a young kid, I loved to write. I mean, you couldn't get me away from a pad of paper. Even before I knew how to form letters, I was just doodling in my father's exam book. So he'd bring home empty exam books. And I wrote all the way through high school. I wrote a novel and the beginning of another novel. But then I got to college, and I realized how terrible my writing was. And then I became an editor, and writing was work because I was reading, you know, for every good manuscript you read 100 not-so-good ones that can't be published.
Right.
And you always you're always listening to the other editors similarly talking about the great American novel they have under their bed, because they've learned all the tricks, you know, by reading a million books and they know what button to push. And if only they had time to finish it, they'd write the book and make billions of dollars. And so the idea of writing just began. Well, it's like the kid in the ice cream store who works, you know, scooping ice cream all day long. You don't want to eat the stuff when you get home. So the impulse to write dried up in me. But I loved computers. Way before anybody else did. I was, you know, as a Doug to a degree, too. We both wrote games and DOS, you know, on the old IBM PC.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
I used computers back in high school when they still had typewriters attached to them. So I went to MetLife, and being away from publishing, ironically enough, brought the interest in writing back. And this is just after I published Doug's first nonfiction book, Dinosaurs in the Attic, which he can tell you about. And he approached me with an idea for a mystery. He was going to call it Zero at the Bone, I think. And I said to him, you know, Doug, mysteries are really hard to write and do well, and they don't sell a lot of copies unless you're Agatha Christie. But what if you were to write a techno thriller set in a museum or a museum similar to the museum you've worked in so many years and know so well, and what if we write it together? And so this opportunity to write Relic, Cult, you know, sort of have it a mesh with my re-interest in writing. That's the long, strange trip that I've been on.
Yeah, that's the very long-winded, strange trip he's been on.
You could have summed it up a little bit quicker, hey, Doug. Not only was that your first collaboration, it was just so well received. It was made into a movie, wasn't it? And that was the first book where we meet Special Agent Pendergast, correct?
That's right. It was kind of peculiar how he came about. Lincoln said to me, "Listen, so we plotted the book. We had this great idea, and Lincoln said, look, you write the first few chapters and send them to me, and I'll rewrite them." So I wrote these, you know, 5 or 10 chapters, and I sent them to Link, and he called me up and he said, "Doug, you know, these are great, but you've got these two cops, this like Irish cop and this Italian cop, and they're both like, you know, rough on the outside with hearts of gold. I mean, they're both the same character, really." He said, "Why don't you combine those characters and let's come up with a detective who's truly unique?" And, of course, by this time I was really irritated at him for not, you know, swooning over my Shakespearean-level prose. And I was really pissed off, and I said, "Oh, yeah, some unique detective like some albino from New Orleans." And there was a silence, and Link said, "You know, Doug, maybe we could work with that." And so we started talking.
That's so
and
funny.
In 15 minutes, AXL Pendergast was standing in front of us, fully formed, like Athena sprung from the forehead of Zeus. And he became our main character. And the odd thing is we knew everything about who he was, like as a person, but we knew nothing about his backstory. In fact, at the beginning, we didn't even know his first name. So it's like he became a real person, and like I would say that now he's more real to me, at least, than many of the so-called real people I actually know.
Have you found that by writing him so much, because you've written so, I think you've written, what, 17 Pendergast books, something like that. Do we get to see more layers of him, do you think, as you're writing? And are you peeling away more layers of him as you write him?
Oh, yeah, we definitely are for two reasons. One, because, you know, as Doug pointed out, we didn't ever plan for him to be a serious character. But he begs to be one because of, you know, all the little sort of throwaway lines we give about his family and the mad, you know, strains go through his family line and this, that, the other
right thing,
and all the weird people in his family. And the second reason is because his fans are so ardent. They're always demanding to know more. So in each book, we, as you say, peel the layer off the onion, and we also lift up the skirt a bit, or in his case, I guess, the trouser cuff, you know, and show a bit more about him than we have before.
How do you feel about aging your character in real time versus in book time? In any of the books, but let's stay with Pendergast for a minute here because he is your most famous character.
Well, he doesn't, you know, that's a very interesting question and something we've grappled with, because if you read Relic, which was written 20 years ago, you'll find that Pendergast had something to do with special ops during the Vietnam War. Well, obviously,
right, he'd
be, you know, in his 70s today if that were the case.
Yes.
But he's not. He's actually still in his early 40s. He's about 40, 41, 42 years old. So he hasn't aged at all. Even though, if you go through the timeline in our books, you'll find that even though our books cover maybe were written over 20 years, the timeline is what, Link? Is it about 5 years, 6 years?
If you go from book to book and connect the dots, about 12 years have passed since Relic. But as you say, Pendergast himself isn't any older.
Yeah, he hasn't aged, and neither of any of the characters around him aged. It's just, we are God. We can stop the aging
process.
There
you go.
Some of
them
but they haven't died of old age.
Well, Sue Grafton's character has remained exactly in the same year. She's had every adventure from A to X now. And all in 1 year. So, I understand that. Some characters age and some don't in books. Now, Doug, you're the one who really likes to write nonfiction books, too. You have quite a backlist of nonfiction books. I think you have, what, six of them, seven now, six?
Books, that's right.
Nonfiction. Lot of them have to – your love of museums and places like that. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Well, I've always, loved writing nonfiction and telling true stories. I've lived a fairly adventurous life and have had quite a few outrageous experiences, and I often write about them. I write for the New Yorker magazine. I write for Smithsonian,
right.
National Geographic, and others like that. And so sometimes I go to very exotic places in the world and tell stories about new discoveries, mostly in science, mostly in archaeology. So, in fact, I have a new book coming out on January 3rd called The Lost City of the Monkey God, which is an incredible true story about the discovery of an actual lost city in the Honduran rainforest last year. Over a mile square, an extraordinary discovery. You wouldn't think it'd be possible in the 21st century, but it did happen, and I was on the expedition to explore that city, so I wrote this book about it.
How fun. That book has actually been reviewed on one of our websites. One of our reviewers has read it and reviewed it already, and she just was blown away by it. It was a fascinating book. So congratulations on that. That release is coming up in January, I know. Where is the most exotic place you feel like you've ever been?
Well, probably that valley in the Mosquitia region of Honduras. It's the thickest jungle in the world, carpets, just relentless mountain chains. And in the middle of these mountain chains are interior valleys that have never been explored, ever. They're among the last places on the surface of the earth that have not been explored, and they're full of jaguars and poisonous snakes and diseases and... they get 10 feet of rain a year. It's just really, but to go into that jungle and to be in this valley where the animals had never seen people and just wandered into camp was so extraordinary.
Wow.
We had monkeys in the trees above us. We had jaguars prowling our tents at night, purring and scaring the hell out of everyone.
I would imagine.
But
yeah.
It was an amazing feeling because you realized you're really in one of the last places on earth where human beings have not conquered, that this is really true wilderness in the real sense of the word.
Wow, that's amazing. Lincoln, are you an adventurer in that same sense?
Hell no. I'm quite the opposite. I'm a homebody.
You want the air conditioning, right?
I'm happy to explore Central Park or the Florida Keys or places like that,
Right.
And
right.
I make up for it with my sick imagination, but I rely on Doug for the real, flavor when it's called for.
Well, Lincoln takes amazing adventurous trips, but they're all interior and they're all in his own mind. And that's something I admire greatly. He has the most wicked imagination. And we were just talking yesterday, we were writing a new Pendergast novel. We ran into some, the usual kind of knots and difficulties. And boy, he just started spinning out these stories out of his head. I was totally, blown away. So,
why, thank you.
No, you're welcome, partner.
I know that you are Lincoln, are an aficionado of H.P. Lovecraft. I can't imagine anyone who writes in the genres that you do who would not be. How much has his work dictated the kind of work you do?
How has H.P. Lovecraft influenced the work I do? Is that your question?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hopefully his writing style has not influenced me too much because he's kind of florid and overwritten and pretentious with his 18th century affectations. But I like to think that, that the sub-basement in the museum in Relic was a direct nod to one of his stories, the rats in the wall, I think. But definitely his ability to, Lovecraft's idea of horror wasn't usually like, zombies or ghouls or
right.
Axe murderers. It was the idea that we were nothing. We were totally insignificant creatures in the cosmos that cared nothing about us, and these other beings much greater than us were engaged in a titanic struggle. And, every now and then a human would learn about them and go crazy because he just couldn't hack it. So I like to think that we like to tease our readers with supernatural seeming elements, but we almost
yes.
always ground it in science. And that, I think, is really somewhat related to our debt to H.P. Lovecraft.
John Sanford told me the same thing. He wrote a science fiction book last year, I think, and he said he always wanted to do that, but he couldn't unless he could ground the science fiction in reality. And so he met a guy who was like a gizmo savant. He knew all these scientific facts and just he was really out there. And so he ended up writing a book with him. And he said it was one of the most rewarding experiences he ever did. I think that's pretty interesting. Do you ever, either of you ever have a desire to step outside the genres that you collaborate in and do something totally different?
Well, that's an interesting question. I love writing these novels with Lincoln especially, but even when I write a solo novel, it's in the same kind of genre, sort of science fiction-y,
right.
but not really. It's more science fact. It's maybe slightly speculative, but not. It doesn't go quite into the science fiction realm. Where I go out of genres when I write nonfiction, but I love that genre. I've often thought about writing a Western because I live in the West and I've had horses, and I've often thought about maybe writing a serious literary novel, but then I think, oh no, how boring, forget that.
My solo novels are very similar to the joint novels too, although my main series character is an enigmologist. He's like the ghost breakers or the supernatural spooks that were very popular 100 years ago. He investigates
uh-huh.
Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, hauntings,
right.
ghost sightings, and tries to either prove them or disprove them. And there are occasions where there is a supernatural that's going on. So, those are the times when I scratch that itch for me, and I'm not afraid to say, hey, maybe there is something ghostly going on here, which we don't do in our joint books.
I need to take a break right now and just remind everyone that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. I'm going to open the phone lines. If you want to say hello to Senors Preston and Child, please give a call at 347-633-9609. That number again is 347-633-9609. Call and tell me what's happening. I'll be glad to go ahead and put you on the line. In the meantime, Lincoln, when I was reading your bio, you're so funny. You say you tried reading War and Peace and gave up after 400 pages, and then you tried reading Gravity's Rainbow and you gave up after 300 pages. You were traumatized by The Exorcist for about 7 months. I love that. I would never watch it. You decided to become a medical journalist after you took a pre-med course and had to dissect a cat. You gave up on that. You've tried a lot of really, really interesting stuff. So, but you've always come back to writing, hey?
Yes. Yes. It's true.
So I love these stories that you tell in your bio, that you've that you tried reading to the lighthouse, and you can fill in the rest, is what you said. And then you said you discovered Jack Daniels, and then you and Doug hooked up to write Relic. So I kind of see the nexus here. You want to talk about that?
Well, first I have to say that To the Lighthouse was the most painful experience of my reading life. I got to within 20 pages of the end of it, and I couldn't force myself to finish the damn book. Tell me, Philistine, if you must, but I just don't like Virginia Woolf.
So did she ever get to the lighthouse?
She croaked after the first part of the book. And the rest of it is all sort of, well, you know, it bored me. I don't want to bore your listeners. But your question is there a nexus when I met Doug?
Here's what happened. Yes, you said you tried reading The Lighthouse. You discovered Jack Daniels. And then the first sowed the seeds of Relic with Doug Preston. I thought that was an interesting triangle there, so I'm trying to hone in on that.
Yes, it was, because by that point, I've been so long since I'd written anything, I was afraid to sort of try writing fiction, because everything I tried to write was really, you know, like Borges, you know, really dense and tight and with a million references and boring as anything to read. And I knew it myself. And so I was afraid to write. And, you know, so for the first part of Relic, Doug did all the writing, except for a couple of chapters that I did. And I did the spinning out of the outlines of the chapters and the rewriting. But, you know, watching him take my outline and fairly effortlessly for him, it seemed, writing chapters got me back into it. And, you know, within a couple of books, we were achieving a lot more of something like parity by in terms of amounts of writing. You know, I like to think that I've learned from my editing and his stuff how to write a bit more sparingly, and I learned from him how to write with humor and just how to spin out an outline into an actual novel.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. So continue, Link.
No, I'm done.
I was curious. How do you decide when you're going to sit down and write another book together? I mean, is there a timeline that you operate on kind of loosely, like, well, once every 6 months we'll go ahead and put together a book, or once a year? I mean, how does it work for you guys? Because obviously you're very busy in your own pursuits. I'm sorry. It works for your
editor?
He calls us
up and says, where's the damn book?
Okay.
Then we have to get down to it. No, that's the flippant answer. Doug, you can give the serious answer.
Well, I was going to say, usually we don't start writing the book till he starts calling us up wondering where the heck the manuscript is. And then we're like, oh, we better get to work here. No, it's what Samuel Johnson once said. He said, nobody but a blockhead ever wrote but for money. Now we don't write now.
Well, there you go.
We love writing, but that's how we make a living. You know, we're supporting our families. We're putting our kids through college. And so, boy, we better keep at it. Otherwise, you know, we're going to be digging ditches again.
There you go. So your books this year are The Obsidian Chamber and Beyond the Ice Limit. Whose idea was the Obsidian Chamber?
Ah.
Who came up with the premise for that one?
You know, I'm trying to think. I think actually Lincoln came up with a premise for that. Isn't that correct, Link?
I think I came up with the idea germ. You know, none of us can say, this is my idea, that's my idea. But one of us can usually say, I had the idea germ for that. And that can be just a sentence. It could be two or three pages, or it could be me on the phone for half an hour trying to convince Doug this is a good idea, you know, or him to me. But yeah, I think even to talk about the idea of the Obsidian Chamber, you know, in a sentence would be a spoiler, so we can't really do it. But I think the idea, Jim, for that was mine. But the really interesting story is how Beyond the Iceland came. Don't you think, Doug? I mean, this is we wrote a one-off called The Icelander that did not star Pendergast many years ago. We wrote a couple of standalone adventure novels. And at the end of the book, it was like that Twilight Zone episode, The Third Man. You know, the humanity is doomed. You know, we're dead meat basically at the end of the ice limit. And we thought there was no need for a sequel, but people started asking us for a sequel at book signings, you know, in emails, and interviews like this one. And we just thought, okay, well, eventually it'll go away. And we wrote a weblog. We wrote these teasers, you know, about what happened afterward, but this endless chorus, like, you know, like a paranoid schizophrenic hears in his head, kept on going on and on and on. And finally they had the idea, we have to write another Gideon Crew book, who's our second series character. Why don't we find who also knew one of the heroes of the Iceland, who in fact works for him, Eli Glynn. And so we decided, let's do this. Let's give our readers what they want. And so it was a fantastic idea, and I don't know who the day that was, but we had such fun writing that book, and Doug wrote the last third, which is an incredible performance on the ship, you know, as they're battling this thing.
Yes.
And we had a lot of fun with that book. So good job, Doug.
Well, thank you. Thank you,
I love this book. This book really kept me up all night, the Beyond the Ice. So I did not want to stop reading it. And I read pretty fast, but there are just some stories that I'm happy that I have a paper copy of, and in this case I have the hardcover for both those books, so that I can really go back and savor some of the dialogue. Dialogue's very strong in your books. And it's very clever, and I really enjoy it a lot. So I have to, and I also have, my book is signed, and it's signed in purple. Which one of you signed it? Because it's Scribble. And I think it might be Link, because it looks like there's an I dotted someplace. So that would be you, correct, Lincoln?
Was it a purple Sharpie?
Yes.
Then it was me, yes.
Yes. Okay, yes. So yes, that's who signed it. I got one of those. So I'm very happy about that. It stays in my treasured collection. Thank you very much. I know you didn't know it was being sent to me, and probably your editor or publicist didn't know she was sending it either. But I have it now, and I'm not giving it back. I'd keep you all night long talking, but I don't want to do that to you. But I would like to know, I know, Doug, you have a book coming out. When do we have another collaborative book coming out between the two of you?
Well, we're working on it right now, and it will be published in October of 2007. And I wish I could give you a title, but we don't have a title. We're arguing about this title, and Lincoln and I is just like, look back to that bad marriage. We're squabbling about the title. So hopefully we'll get something good.
Except in this case, we're squabbling with our publisher.
Yes, that's right.
How are you? Now, do you normally name your books, or does your publisher name them?
We normally name them. Certain titles were suggested by our publisher that we love and we accepted. But normally we name the books, and then the publisher will often reject our idea and come back at us, and we'll go back and forth and back and forth, and eventually we'll come up with a name that everyone's satisfied with. Like, for example, The Obsidian Chamber. We proposed that name, and our publisher said, wait a minute, nobody's going to know what the word obsidian means. Let's call it the Midnight Chamber. And we said, no, Midnight Chamber, that's just so generic. You know, even if people don't know what obsidian means, what obsidian means, it'll be intriguing to them. And also, our readers are very smart. They're smarter than most people, and most of them are going to know what obsidian means. So I think we prevailed against them that time, but sometimes they don't like our ideas.
that year was this year was unique because we insisted on both titles. You know, we got pushback on both of them, but we insisted on both of them, and our publisher agreed on both of them. It doesn't usually happen. Usually, we go back and forth and back and forth.
Well, they're spectacular. I want to ask you about one of my favorite books before I let you go, and that is The Cabinet of Curiosities. There have been so many copies of that book, so many people who've tried to write something similar. There have been so many graphic novels. There have been so many little roadside shops and curiosity stands. Tell me, can you just briefly tell me about The Cabinet of Curiosities and how it came to be? It is a delightful book, I have to tell you. As creepy as it is, it's a delightful book. It was a pleasure to read it.
Well, thank you. I believe that, you know, not to toot my own horn, but I think that the germ of the idea was mine. But then Lincoln, mm-hmm. you know, we had these wonderful discussions about that book, and we just took off. I mean, the idea really took off. And the passages in that book that are written in the 19th century in that wonderful
mm-hmm.
style were all written by
yes.
Lincoln. I've never seen anyone actually capture the 19th century Victorian writing style like he could. I was so impressed with those passages. But, yeah, it was...
My other contribution
really
was the...
visual. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to talk over you. I wanted to just tell you, though, from a reader's standpoint, I will tell you that that particular book created a real visual delight for me. I'm very easily to form like a little movie in my head when I start reading. And I had so much fun reading that book. And it was just a splendid array of color and character. And, you know, the world building in that book was amazing. I have to thank you so much for writing it. It was just beautiful.
Well, thank you. We think that was one of our most successful books. We really do. People tell us they love that one the most, and it certainly is a grim and highly original idea.
It certainly is. Do you have fun when you're writing? Do you enjoy writing, Lincoln?
It's hard work. It's, you know, there are days when I've got to go around and paint the house or do the dishes, you know, then write. But, you know, writing with Doug is a lot easier than writing on my own because you got a partner that you respect and that you trust, and that if you have a mental block, you can talk to him, and usually we resolve our problems right away. You know that somebody else is going to be reading over what you wrote and seeing if you're going in the right direction or not, which are benefits you don't have on a solo book. I mean, a solo book has benefits of its own too. Some tangible, some intangible. You can hold it up and say, I wrote this and nobody else did, which is a nice thing. But you don't have that
mm-hmm.
partnership and that friend who's on the journey with you.
What about you, Doug? Do you like writing? When you sit down at your whatever your office space looks like and sit down to write, is it a pleasurable thing for you, even if it's difficult? Do you enjoy doing that?
It is. I love it. I mean, I love it. I don't ever feel reluctant to go to work. I like to get up. I walk to work. I have a little half-a-mile walk to my office, and I get down to work. I just really enjoy it. I mean, writing is difficult, and it's not easy even for someone who's written 35 books like Lincoln and I have.
No.
It's very tough.
Right.
But I don't know. It's one of the funnest things I've ever done. Well, in terms of work, I wouldn't go into the other things that are more fun, but anyway.
The things you don't want to talk about on the radio. I met you both
and we don't
at a Thrillerfest one year. Yeah, we don't want to know about that. That'll be a different show. This one is rated PG. I met you or heard you at a Thrillerfest one year, and I just wonder, do you enjoy passing on craft to younger writers? Do you get frustrated? What is it like when aspiring writers come to you for advice?
Depends on whether or not they bring money with them.
Yeah, yeah. we are both of us like mentoring writers, young writers. It's you know, we remember so vividly, and it only seems like yesterday when we were struggling, unknown writers, desperate to get published or desperate to have a seller, you know, desperate to have people read our books. It's so vivid in our memories that, you know, we really do have a lot of empathy for writers now beginning, you know, debut writers just starting out and what a struggle
sure.
it is. So we like to do what we can to help them out. I mean, Lincoln and I give blurbs to young writers. We help mentor them. We sometimes teach classes. We do a lot of things that we hope will help encourage other people to become writers.
There's a section on our website devoted to helping people learn how to be better writers, too.
And that's not the bio section. I know that. Because
no.
then if they kept reading that, they'd be no, I see it. You do have videos in there, and you have a lot of information on your site. Have you been to your site lately? Do you know what it looks like, by the way? I don't know if you even go
sure.
on your website. It's pretty interesting. You have a parrot on your shoulder, Lincoln. So
yeah,
it's a very young you, I would imagine. Yeah.
That was
so,
me about 20 years.
Very about 20 years ago. Oh, how cute. That's funny. I cannot thank you both enough for spending so much time with me tonight for my comeback show after being sick. And here you are. Just a load of fun, and it's been an honor and a pleasure to speak to you both. I wish you both a happy holiday and much success in the new year, although that seems kind of ridiculous for me to say it to you, Lincoln Child and Douglas Preston, who are, you know, you're published in so many other countries. How many languages in other countries are you published in? Do you know?
We lost count, but it's in the dozens now.
Yes, I think last I read it was like 27 different languages or something. So congratulations on all your success and my absolute gratitude for coming on the show tonight. I've had a blast. You've really made my comeback a lot of fun. Thank you so much. And happy holidays to you both and a happy new year.
Well, thank you very much. We love being on the show, and I hope we weren't too obstreperous and interrupting all the time. But anyway, we certainly enjoyed the
great.
Show. And
all right. Oh, thank
well,
you.
Well, good. And have a very happy holiday to you, too, and all your
thank
listeners.
Thank you.
Yeah, feel better.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good one, gentlemen. Thank you so much. Good night.
Bye-bye now.
And that, folks, is an interview you'll never hear anyone else. On Wednesday, Book of the Year, it's our awards night, so please stay with us. I want to thank you for being with me. Thank you, Mom and Dad.